Hello, everybody. Welcome to the second lecture of the Why Capitalism course. We have a small select group. So far, we don't even have enough for a minion, but I'm hoping this will get more as time goes on in the lecture. At least we'll see what happens. What happened here? Now, in the section we had from Henry Hazlitt's book on how the price system works, Hazlitt starts off by making a really basic point that's the key point in the whole book that he wrote, Economics in One Lesson. And we'll see how he applies this point to a particular question of great interest to us in this course right away. And the principle that he says is that in economics, we have to consider all the consequences of policy. Suppose we're considering any policy you like, such as rent control, minimum wage, price controls of other kind. What we would do is not just consider who are the immediate beneficiaries of the policy. For example, people say they want rent control because maybe some people will be able to get rent apartments at a lower cost than they would have paid without rent control, so they would benefit from that. But Hazlitt said, well, look, in economics, we have to consider not just who immediately benefits or immediately is hurt by the policy, we have to consider all the consequences of the policy. And very often, people don't do this. They'll tend just to look at a policy in isolation or consider only the short-run consequences. For example, people will favor inflation. They say this will give people money right away so they can go out and buy things. This will revive the economy. But they don't consider possible long-run consequences. Maybe this will run out of control and the money supply will become so inflated that people lose confidence in the whole money supply, so it'll have very bad consequences later. And in addition to considering the long-run consequences, not just what happens right away, the long-run consequences, it's also necessary to consider alternatives. What would happen if you did something else? For example, if you say, you want to help workers by having a redistribution of wealth to them. What would happen if you didn't do that but just didn't redistribute wealth? What would happen if you let the rich people just keep their money? What would be the consequences for workers or the poor people then? And you'll see this example wasn't just picked at random. It's one that will come up later in the lecture. But we have two points here. We have to consider for a policy not just the immediate consequences, but the long-run consequences. And we don't just consider something in isolation from the rest of the economy. We consider all the economy. We also take account of what would have been the case if we did something else. We consider alternatives. And this principle that we have to take account of all these consequences is, wasn't mentioned in this chapter, you probably know this is the famous broken window fallacy, supposed to illustrate that Frederick Bastiat had, supposed to illustrate what happens if you don't follow this principle. Remember, in that case, someone throws a brick through a window and then somebody else says, well, look how good this is, because then the store owner will have to buy a new pane of glass to replace the broken window. This will help the glass maker and that he'll spend the money on other things. So this will benefit everybody. And what's overlooked is, well, if the a person hadn't broken the window, then the store owner would have spent the money on something else that would have had other consequences. Other people would have spent the money on other things and we wouldn't have the broken window. So see here, we're not considering alternatives. Now the application of this principle that we have to consider all the alternatives that Hazlitt is concerned with in this chapter 15 that we had to read is this, that it used to be the case, it isn't so much now, but socialists, say in the 1930s and 40s and earlier periods, used to criticize capitalism for not producing enough. What they said was, look, suppose we had a system where everything were planned by experts, and we had engineers who were directing things instead of capitalist businessmen, we would be able to produce much more because then we would be able to organize things on a scientific basis. Now, in the free market capitalism, production is limited because businessmen will stop producing when it's no longer profitable. Let's say someone's a shoe manufacturer. So he's going to produce a certain number of shoes, and then supposing after he supplies a certain number of shoes, he thinks if he supplies more, that'll not result in more profits for him. The cost of producing the shoes will be greater than what he thinks he's going to take in revenue. So he won't produce these shoes. But maybe if we had production organized scientifically, we'd see people really need more shoes. So we wouldn't be limited to just going by what would be profitable for businessmen. We could just say, well, people need more, certain number of shoes. We have the capacity, technical capacity to produce that number of shoes. So we shouldn't be limited by just saying, well, what do businessmen need, how much should they produce in order to make profit? We could just say, people need so many shoes. We have the capacity to produce those, so let's go ahead and do that. So this argument would be capitalism is unduly limiting production because it's saying that we should just produce what's needed for what the amount that's required so businessmen can make a profit. If a businessman thinks, I'm not going to make a profit anymore, he's going to stop producing. As I say, this argument isn't as popular as it used to be. There was a movement, I wonder if any of you heard of it, called technocracy. Does anyone know that of our group? Has anyone heard of technocracy? It was very popular in the 1930s. It was an organ. It started by, someone said, 80s band. Now that one, I'm afraid I'm not up with popular culture. I never heard of them. Well, they were moving there. I think they were founded by an engineer named Scott. That was the last name. And he thought that production should be organized scientifically instead of having money. We have a currency based on energy units, and he had very elaborate plans on how this would be done. So he was one of these people, besides the socialists, who were saying, oh, if only we organized production scientifically, we'd be producing for what people needed, because we'd production for use, so we'd get a much better system than under capitalism, which is just based on production for profit. Of course, the socialists use that argument also. There were others who used that argument, similar arguments, like the famous economist Thorstein Veblen. Had a book, The Engineers and the Price System, where he said, well, capitalism is really controlled by this class of capitalists who really aren't doing very much. If only the engineers and really scientific and productive people could take over, things would be much better. But this argument, as I say, isn't as popular as it used to be, because the Soviet Union was supposed to be this big socialist state planning everything. And the socialists thought in the 30s and 40s, they'd say, well, either we don't like some feature of the Soviet system. After all, they're more productive than we are, so they're going to surpass us before long. You find Paul Samuelson, the author of the most influential textbook used in American economics course, was saying that the Soviet Russia's more productive than America. But as you know, the Soviet Union collapsed in around 1990-91. So socialists can't say, well, look how productive it is if we plan everything scientifically, because it just didn't turn out that way. So today, most social people who are still socialists will say that capitalism is an unjust system. They'll have arguments dealing with equality and so on. And they don't say, at least not as much as they used to, that socialism is more efficient than capitalism. But nevertheless, that was at one time an influential argument. So we have to see what's wrong with the argument. Remember, the argument is that under capitalism, what determines how much of a good, we gave the example of shoes, is produced will be what the business people who are producing that good find profitable. But the argument is, if we produce in a more scientific basis, we'd ask, how much do people need? Say, how many shoes can people use? So once we had that figure, we just say, do we have the technical capacity to produce that number of shoes? So even if it turns out to be a much larger number than the free market produces, we could still produce that. So the argument would be, doesn't that show that the production run according to a plan is better than production under capitalism, because it's not limited by what the capitalist wants to get for his profit? You can just produce as much as your technical capacity allows, so long as people want the good. But here's where this lesson we were talking about before, where we said we have to consider not things just in isolation, we have to consider the total picture and all the consequences comes in. What this argument is ignoring, it says, well, look, we could just keep producing shoes as long as people needed them. It's ignoring the fact that resources are limited. And say, if we're devoting more resources to producing shoes than are used in the free market, then less is available to produce other goods. It isn't that we can just keep producing one good and just increase the resources devoted to that good without any sacrifices elsewhere in the economy. We're always faced with a choice between alternatives. And this is a fundamental principle of economics, that when we don't just say, here's something that I want, so I'm going to do that. We always have to consider, what are the alternative choices that are open to one in acting? What are the alternatives that you can do with your time? And if some of you studied Mises' praxeology, will realize this is a basic feature of action. Action always involves the choice between alternatives. So it isn't just we say, well, we want more shoes, so we're going to produce shoes. We would have to say, we want more shoes as opposed to something else. So we have to then make a choice. So you see what's wrong with the argument we're given. We were given before where the person favors that, other than just saying, look, we have a capacity to produce more shoes than we do now. So this shows what's wrong with capitalism, because we're artificially limiting the number of shoes we're producing just based on what's profitable for the shoe manufacturers. And this is ignoring the fact that, sure, it's right that we could produce more shoes, but this is at the expense of other things. Now, how in the free market is this question settled? Say, how do we know how many shoes to produce, how many tables, how many lectures on Austrian economics to have? How are these things decided? Well, as you know, everyone knows about economics that supply and demand determine prices. The price of good will depend on how much of a good people want, and want in the sense that they're willing to pay for, and how much suppliers of good are supplying. So what happens if consumers want more of a certain product? Let's say, for example, there's a great demand for my lectures. That's not going to happen, but let's just suppose that. It gives me a good feeling to suppose that, however improbable a state of affairs the supposition describes. Okay, so people want more of my lectures, so they'll bid up the price of this. Now, actually, you know, that wasn't the best example, but we could go with that. All right, well, there's a problem with that example. Let's go with that. So people will, let's say people will start enrolling in the lecture, so then the people who are offering the Mises Academy will say, oh, well, there's a lot of demand for this lecture. Maybe we could increase the price and see what happens. So it could maybe we'd be able to get more money if we increase the price, because a whole lot of people are demanding it. So it isn't here the people are bidding up the price, but here the ones who are offering the lecture thing, maybe we have an opportunity to increase the price we're charging. Now, this wouldn't happen with lectures. So let's take a different example. Let's go back to shoes. Shoes are always more fun than lectures anywhere, depending on what kind of shoes and lectures at any rate. So let's suppose consumers want more shoes, so there's an increased demand for them, and if there's a certain number, only limited number of shoes are available, people will bid up the price. One person will say, well, I want these shoes. I'm willing to pay more than the other guy for them, so the price will go up. Now, what happens if the price goes up? Well, then suppliers will increase the supply of the good. They'll say, oh, we can make more money here, so we're going to make more shoes. And also, when you have an increased demand for something, that'll attract new firms into producing the product. They'll say, oh, well, look, people are demanding shoes now, so we can make money by going into that field. Here's an opportunity to earn a profit. Now, what happens as production of the good increases? Say there are more and more people producing shoes, or the existing shoe manufacturers are making more shoes, then the price will go down. This is because there's an increased supply. If there's an increased supply of something, then you can see why prices will go down, because the sellers, in order to sell what they've got, will make better offers to buyers, and better offer to a buyer is a lower price. So the price will go down if supply increases. Now, what happens if the price goes down? Then the higher profits that attract to the new entrants will lessen, because remember, they were coming in because they said, oh, look, people really want shoes. The price of shoes has gone up, so we can go in and we'll make some profits here. But when supply increases and the higher profits are going to go down. And because of this process, that if somebody has some good that seems extra profitable, it'll attract new people into that line of production, which will lower the profit rate. The rate of return on invested capital will return to normal. It's just what I said. You see, people are making these extra returns on their investment, so new people come in and that lowers the rate of return. And because of this, we got the rate of return on capital tends to be equal in the economy. If you could make more in a certain line of production than elsewhere, then you'll just get people going into that line of production and driving the rate of return down. And if there's some line of production that's unprofitable, then people will move out of that into other areas, and that'll get the return up. It's just the reverse of what we described. Now, as people leave the industry that isn't doing so well, that decreases the supply, and that will tend to raise the price, so then that'll stop the rate of return from falling. And so you'll get a tendency to equalize the rate of return throughout the economy. Summing up what we've said so far is, when resources move into the product with an increase in demand, it's at the expense of other products. So you see what was wrong with this original argument that said we should have production for use and not for profit. That argument was saying, look, we could produce, technically we can produce much more of any good you want, like shoes, than capitalists find profitable. So doesn't that show we could have some better, more efficient system than capitalism? And the answer is no, because that argument is ignoring the fact that if you produce more of one good, you're producing less of another. Now, here, I didn't put this on the slide. Could anyone think of what would be a reply someone who was a socialist who favored central planning could give to this argument that says that if you increase the production of one good, then you're going to be shifting resources from some other good, so you're not going to have an increase in total production, you're just going to be shifting from one good to another. Could anybody think of what a socialist might reply now? Danny says scarcity is a capitalist myth. Well, that's actually sort of a cruder version of what some of the socialists would say. What they claimed was that you wouldn't always have a shift from one resource to another, because capitalism is using resources at less than their full capacity. So you could increase something without a decrease somewhere else, but they weren't able to make that claim good. There's an essay by Mises, I think, which we reprinted, a couple essays by Mises reprinted in, I think, in Epistemological Problems of Economics that go into that. But that's just a side point. I didn't put that into the main lecture, but they would just claim there's an economy isn't in equilibrium. There's an underuse of all resources. Sometimes Keynesians say that could happen in a depression, but so that's how they respond to that. But basically, they're not right. It's generally the case that if resources move into one product, it's at the expense of other products. And the price system is this mechanism by which goods are shifted to meet changes in demand. So if there's an increase in the demand for one good, say shoes, then the price will go up. This will attract new entrants and encourage people who are already in the industry to expand production. So then there'll be a response to the increase in demand. So this is the whole bases and how Dan pointed out the Keynesian idol. Yes, W. H. Hutt did write on that. Yes, now Peter says, I think Tom would give an example. There's no scarcity, it would mean you can just click your finger and the things you want would come up. Yes, I mean, saying there's no scarcity at all would be a quite extreme assumption to make. That's sort of an obviously wrong one, but there were some socialists who were better than that. They didn't say there was no scarcity at all, but they just said there's more scarcity than you need to have under capitalism. You see, that's wrong, but it's less obviously wrong than the claim you were suggesting. Now, one thing interesting to note that Hazlitt brings out is that it's wrong to say that past costs determine price. One view would be, well, the businessman will just determine prices by just saying, how much did it cost me to produce something? And then the businessman will say, okay, it cost me such and such to produce it. Then I just add a profit rate, and that'll get me the price. Now, that's actually kind of an accounting way they might look at price in accounting, but it isn't really right. What's wrong with that? Well, suppose you incurred a certain cost, like you made shoes, so you cost you certain money to get all the material together, so you paid out all the money again. So there's nothing you can do about that money you paid. You have the goods on hand, and now you have to decide how much to charge for them. You can say, well, I want to charge enough to cover my costs, but that might not be the best price for you to charge. It might have been you made a mistake. So if you charge enough to cover your costs, you won't be getting very much in return. Someone could just say, you know, I want to charge $50,000 to give this lecture, but I'm not going to get $50,000 just from the fact you say you want to have a certain price. It doesn't mean you're going to get that price. So just because you've incurred certain costs, you say, well, unless I get a certain price, I'm not going to be able to cover my costs. That doesn't give you a reason to charge that, because what you want to determine is what will get you the most money, most revenue, what price will get you the most revenue. If it covers your costs, all the better. But just saying, well, it has to cover, I have to cover my costs, so I have to charge this amount of money, isn't a good idea, because you might be able to get more money if you charge a different price. You might have wrongly incurred that cost, so what you have to do then is minimize your losses, and a charging price that covers your costs might not do that. So this is sometimes summed up in the phrase, bygones are bygones, there's nothing you can do about it. Now, Hazlitt also points out, though, that when a businessman is deciding how much to produce, he can take into account estimates of future cost. He'll say, well, if I were to produce 10,000 shoes, this will cost me such and such amount of money. Do I think at the price I'll be charging, I'll be able to recover that amount of money? If he said no, it would be a good reason not to get into that field. But you see how that's different. That's saying you're estimating your future cost will influence how much you're going to produce. It isn't that what you've spent in the past, your costs are determining the price. It's you're estimating how much you're going to get in the future and weighing that against your future cost. And of course, it will turn out we're not going to be covering in this lecture that costs are themselves determined by the demand for the goods you pay for in your production goods as in alternative uses. So it's really, as we would see in a more advanced course, it's really people's utility, what people want with different goods, including production goods, that's determining cost rather than cost determining prices. So it's really the utility is really the most fundamental thing in determining price. But I say that's a more advanced point. What we have to realize now is that it's not past costs that determine prices. Now, if you recall the previous lecture, remember we were talking about Mises was emphasizing that in the capitalist system, it's the consumers who are really in charge, because business people are trying to make a profit, and to make a profit, they have to meet consumer demand. And what we've been doing so far in this lecture, where I've talked about the price system and how goods shift from production resources will shift to goods that are more demanded from others that are less demanded, is explain how this process that Mises is talking about takes place. Why is how? Suppose you say consumers are in command, what their businessmen are trying to determine what to produce. So they'll say, what will make a profit? So how does this work? Well, it's just in this way we've explained, that through the price system, that increases in demand will increase prices, and this will encourage people to go into that industry. So this is how Mises is saying takes place. And remember, in Mises' view, he's saying that the consumers are really, by their demand indicating what they want to pay for the product, we can take them as voting for the products they want. So really, it's not a political democracy. It's somewhat like a democracy in that people's dollar votes are ultimately determining what's being produced. I think it was interesting, at least I found it interesting, that in the reading selection we had for this lecture, Mises uses the expression of daily repeated plebiscite to describe the market. Now, did any of you get, you can see it on my slide, but did any of you get where does that phrase come from? Did that ring a bell with any of you when you read the phrase, a daily repeated plebiscite? Well, I see we're all rushing to the chance. Now, Kevin, that sounds Rothbard. Well, it actually came a little before Rothbard. This is actually slightly modified from, there was a very famous essay that came out in 1882 on nationalism by Ernest Renan. Now, Renan was one of the greatest French writers of the late 19th century. He was an Orientalist, an authority on the history of religion, especially Semitic religion. He wrote a famous Life of Jesus. He was also a very influential writer about nationalism. He said a nation is a daily plebiscite. He said people are, by being in a nation, are really deciding that they want to be together. So what Mises is doing here, of course, Mises was very familiar with European cultures, so he's applying this phrase, daily plebiscite, to the market. It's one that he would probably be assuming that his readers would recognize. So it comes from Renan. He's certainly an author you should look up if you have the time. He's very much worth reading. He had a very nice style. Everybody should read his essay on nationalism. It's one of the classics. I should say Mises takes this idea of consumer control extremely seriously. It isn't just something he says now and then. This is one of the main themes. If you read Human Action, you'll find this idea expressed quite a lot, that the consumers are really in control in under capitalism. He goes so far as to say the consumers are the real owners of productive property. He says in various places that the people who are the legal owners are really acting as just following the mandate of the consumers. We could take the real legal owners as just administrators, people who are following the people's will in producing what the people want. And why does he say that? Well, we can understand that from what we've talked about already in the lecture, that suppose you own a business, but you don't do what the consumers want. You just say, well, forget the consumers. I'll do it my way. You're not Frank Sinatra, so you might not what's going to happen? Well, then you'll tend to go out of business, and you'll be replaced by someone who meets consumer demand better. So you see what Mises' argument is. He's saying, look, people are in business to make a profit, and the way you make a profit is you satisfy the consumer, so it's really consumers are in control. So you might, now, well, what about people who don't produce directly for consumers? What about people who make machinery? Let's say somebody just makes some product, like some kind of, someone's a ball bearing manufacturer, makes ball bearings that are used in factories. Well, he's not selling directly to consumers, but his demand will be determined by what industries that use ball bearings in their work, and ultimately this will trace back to what consumers want, because the consumers will want certain things, and then the businesses that produce those things immediately will do well, and then this will their demand will, they'll be the consumers for the next stage of production, and so on. So consumers doesn't have to be just people. We think of consumers as opposed to producers. We can think of the producers at one level of being the ones who are determining demand at the next level. You can see how this works. So it's ultimately the consumers in the ordinary sense, the people who are using the final products, who are really directing things. And I think Mises places a great deal of stress on this point. Now, Mises, this is, I think, a very interesting point. We can deal a bit with political philosophy here. Is he uses this point to defend private property. Remember, at the time he was writing, private property, capitalism, was under attack from a lot of people. They said, well, why should this special group of capitalists, these rich plutocrats, claim that they should own all the capital in the economy? Why should they be the owner of productive assets? These assets really belong to the people as a whole. We should get rid of these people who claim to be the owners and just replace them with some popular, I just have the people own things. I just see Cam has, apparently he was trying to get some PDFs. He said he kept finding only in Hebrew, which is a bit tough to read, especially if you try to read it left to right. It's right to left. That's the key to remembering it. That's a, you have to know that as a necessary but not sufficient condition for being able to read Hebrew. Okay, so this argument, so what Mises is replying to that argument now, the socialist is saying, okay, then we should have, the people should own the capital goods, not these rich owners. Mises says, well, look, under capitalism, the people really do own things, so you're getting what you want. The people that are legally the owners are just the mandatories, the people who are carrying out the orders of the consumers. So he's saying to the socialists, look, you say you want to have popular ownership of all the goods, the production goods in the economy, but that's what we've really got already. We don't need what your system. Now, many of us, I think I would certainly be inclined to say, oh, but look, shouldn't we just, don't we want to say people have a right to property? Isn't just a matter of saying what's good for the consumers? What about natural rights to property? As we don't, you have a right, you know, everyone knows the argument, everyone's a self-owner and you can homestead property, so then that becomes your property also. We all know this argument. I think that's a good argument, but Mises doesn't like that argument. He says, well, suppose you say there's a natural right to property, what if somebody just says, I don't accept that, I say there's a natural right to equality. So he says, well, he can avoid this kind of controversy on which natural rights you appeal to. Mises himself regards appeals to natural rights as really arbitrary. He says, look, you can show under capitalism it's really the people who do own productive assets, so the socialists are really getting what they want. So then he can sidestep the need to argue from natural rights. Now, Malcolm asks, I see, did Rothbard come to property rights from this direction of an a priori methodology? Well, Rothbard argued to property rights from a natural rights perspective, but that isn't really, well, I don't know whether you'd call it a priori. No, I think it would be based on certain empirical necessities about human nature. So I don't think it would be either. It would be more of a natural law argument. Now, Travis says individual rights or property rights. There's no such thing as group rights, only individual rights. We're not creating. Oh, well, Mises wouldn't be claiming that, in his argument, wouldn't be claiming that consumers taken as some group or the owner. It would be individual consumers, but consumers are exercising their dollar votes in the one production is going according to the way those dollar votes dictate, except it isn't a winner-take-all basis, but he isn't claiming that there's some entity other than individuals who are the owners, just in the individuals who are in the group of consumers are, according to him, the real owners. Now, you remember last week, we mentioned an objection to this theory of consumer sovereignty, as it's called. This is one that Rothbard raised. Remember the phrase consumer sovereignty was one I think was first used by W.H. Hutt, the same economist that Danning mentioned earlier for his work on theory of idle resources. So what the objection is, well, we can say that Mises says, well, the consumers are the real owners of property, but the objection is, well, this isn't really like ownership in the legal sense. Because in the legal sense, if you're the owner of something, you have a jurisdiction over your property. You can say, this is your property. You can tell somebody else to get off your property. So if the consumers were the real owners of productive assets, they could tell a businessman, you must do something. You're producing shoes now, but we want you to shift and give all your money to the Mises Academy. We're the legal owner. We're the owner, so you have to do this. So the businessman could say, I'm not going to do it this way. I'm going to do it my way. Look, you can tell me you'd like such and such a product, but I'm not going to do it that way. Legally belongs to me. So then, couldn't we say then that Mises' whole argument is wrong? Because he says, well, the consumers are the real owners of productive property under capitalism. But in fact, somebody could just say, the consumers, forget it. I'm just going to run the business the way I want. If you don't like it, you know where you can go. It turns out, I thought this was quite valuable to note in the reading selection we had for this lecture, is that Mises is very much aware of this objection. It isn't that someone just, say, Rothbard just came up with this and Mises never thought of that. He was aware of that, and he admits that's right, but he says that the way in which it's true to say the consumers are the real owners is that businessmen are responding to incentives. If, say, we imagine this businessman who said, look, let's imagine somebody who owns a certain restaurant, and he said, I'm just going to have the food that I want to serve. I'm not trying to please the consumers, people who come in here. I don't care what they want. This is what I want. We're going to have serve Indian elephants here, nothing else. We're not going to serve. This is what I want to serve. You people don't like elephant steak. That's too bad. Well, he can certainly do that. He's legally free to do that. But if consumers don't want it, if he can't get enough people coming in, then he's going to go out of business. So since businessmen are in business to earn a profit, they're going to be responsive to incentives. Now, one way, so you see, Mises has anticipated Rothbard on this point. He said, well, you know, you're right, the consumers aren't legally sovereign, but in fact that businessmen will respond to what the consumers want because they're trying to make a profit. And Mises, so we can then contrast two ways of control. That one would be how you get somebody to do something. Well, one way is to give them a positive incentive to do it. Say, you'll say to the person, I'll give you money or something else that you want if you do things my way. And the other is to use force, a threat of force. You say, well, if you don't do what I want, I'm going to shoot you or hit you over the head with something. And Mises contrasts these two ways of getting people to do something. He contrasts power and the market. So some people don't realize his contrast. For example, the editor of a magazine called American Conservative, Dan McCarthy, had a post recently where he said, well, look, he favors a generally free market, but if you just had the pure free market, that would give too much power to the property owner. So we need a political system to balance that, to make sure that the ones who own the property don't have too much power. But I think what he was not realizing was that in a market doesn't operate by means of power. It isn't that the property owners are saying to other people, you have to do what we say. It's rather in the free market is where people can cooperate voluntarily. People, if everyone had to try to produce everything for himself, suppose you had to grow your own food or build your own house, most people wouldn't do very well. We'll all do better if we specialize in something and then just exchange what we produce with others so we get more, we benefit from the division of labor. Since we each produce something, instead of each of us trying to produce everything for ourselves, we each produce something separately. I guess the question from Malcolm on power market, was that a way of distinguishing from Mises? No, I mean, I think that would be in agreement with Mises. He wasn't trying to distinguish his views from Mises there. So, as I say, the free market capitalism is based on mutual advantage. So we say, I can make an exchange with you and we'll both benefit from it. This is the basic principle of capitalism. We're benefiting from social cooperation. We can each get more of what we want by cooperating with other people, and we may freely decide to get into exchanges with them based on what is benefit to us both. So this way of dealing with other people by cooperating with them peacefully has to be contrasted with the state, which rests on force. And there, Mises would agree. Do any of you know Joseph de Maistre? Is that a name that people are familiar with? Oh, good. Travis knows him. Good. Well, he was he was actually from Savoy, but he lived in France for various periods of his life, and he was a very famous conservative writer, an opponent of the French Revolution, and he had a famous comment: "The state rests on the executioner," meaning by that the state ultimately rests on violence. It's saying to people, if you don't do what we say, we're going to force you to do that, and if necessary, we'll kill you. And so Mises agrees with that. He says the state is the means. He says that they can beat people into submission. So he's contrasting the power of the state versus the market. This is a theme that you'll find very much in Franz Oppenheimer and Albert J. Nock and Murray Rothbard. You contrast relationships based on voluntary activity versus the state, which is based on power. So what happens if you don't rely on the free market? Well, then the alternative is to have the economy centrally directed. If you don't rely on the free market, then there'll have to be someone who's directing the economy, someone saying how things are to be produced. And this will result really, now you could imagine just firms producing independently but not relying on the market, but that wouldn't get you very, that would be a very bad way of doing things, that would unproductive way, that would be called syndicalism. You should look up the treatment of that Mises gives to syndicalism and socialism if you're interested in that. But the basic point we have here is that I think Danny had some point about the Fasces, the similar Roman state. I think that's right what you say there. People could look that up. But okay, so if you don't rely on the free market, then you're going to have someone in control, someone telling people what to do. Now, supposing someone said, okay, that's true, but people can still be free because you're only telling them what to do in the economic sphere. You could say you'd have a central direction of production. You could say people might still be politically free even though the economy is centrally directed. But Mises points out that that isn't a very good argument. That wouldn't work because in order to act, you need access to material goods. Say I'm going to do something. I need to use resources to do whatever it is. Say, suppose you said something like, well, we're going to have a socialist economy, but we're going to retain rights to free speech. Well, how would that be possible? The government controls all access to print and other media. So we could say, well, you're guaranteed free speech, but the government will decide whether you get the access to anything by which you can spread your views. So that wouldn't be a very workable system. There's also a point, incident, that one Mises made here, is one that Friedrich Hayek made in his famous book of 1944, The Road to Serfdom, that you can't separate a political sphere from the economic sphere and say, well, we're just concerned economics with this kind of material goods, but the real higher freedom we can have if we have socialist control of the economy. Now, when Mises was talking about the state, as I mentioned, he thinks that the state rests on force. So what you would have in remember, we talked about this in the last lecture, that Mises is seeing history really up till capitalism, is a way in which there was a dominant class that was really exploiting the other classes, say, under ancient slavery and under feudalism. We can even draw some parallels with Mises and Marx here, that these earlier systems were based on exploitation of by one group of another. And Mises was not an egalitarian in the sense he believed everybody had equal ability. He believed very strongly that some people were more able than others, they were smarter or stronger, and that these elite groups would tend to dominate. So he thought throughout most of history, there have been elite groups that have exploited the masses, but capitalism has changed things, not because it gets rid of the elites, but it allows the masses to benefit from the creativity of the elites. Because under capitalism, say the way somebody who's kind of very creative or smarter than other people can make money is to produce what people want. So instead of having an elite exploiting people, it's going to be a system where the elite is trying, using its abilities to benefit the masses of the people. Now, socialists sometimes say, well, it may be, if you're right, the elite is trying, it makes money, the capitalists make money by trying to please the consumers, but there's too much inequality under capitalism. They would point out, and they're quite right about this, there are some people who are much richer than others under capitalism. So Mises is, as you might imagine, is not very sympathetic to this idea that there's too much inequality. And he objects on a number of grounds to this view. The socialists say there's too much inequality. He says, well, first of all, supposing you say the rich people can buy luxuries that aren't available to the poor. So he says, well, it's true sometimes rich people have certain products the poor don't have. But once people know about these products, these luxuries, then businessmen will work out a way to make them into mass products. So what started off as a luxury can become a mass product a short time later. Mm-hmm. And he cites in this connection, there was a 19th century sociologist, French sociologist, Gabriel Tarde, who wrote on imitation. So what he said is, well, say you find something being produced, then other people will take up that idea and they'll try to come up with other ways of producing that. So products will spread in that way through imitation. Now, Mises raises another objection to this argument, there's too much inequality. Well, he says most people who say that don't favor complete equality. The great playwright George Bernard Shaw did favor complete equality, but most people don't. But if you say, well, there's just too much inequality, there's no natural stopping point. Suppose you said, okay, we cut down on inequality by 50%. Is that all right now, or do we still need more? There's no real way of answering that question. Now, there's a related objection that people give to the to capitalism that Mises considers, related objection to this claim that there's too much inequality. Some people say, well, workers under capitalism are exploited. This is a view you'll find Marxists say this. They say because, say, the workers produce a certain product, they don't get the full value of what they produce. They'll just get a certain amount of wages, but some amount will go to the owner of the firm as a return on his investment. Some amount goes to the landlord. So they say, well, the workers are exploited because they're not getting the full value of what they produced. So what's wrong with this is that it ignores the role of capitalism factor production, that if you have, say, when the workers are working, they aren't the ones who are responsible for the full value of the product. They're using the capital goods. This helps them to produce more. It's true, you couldn't produce goods without labor, but the laborers would be much less productive. They didn't have access to capital. And in fact, when labor produces more and then gets more in wages because it's more productive, gains in labor productivity are generally due to the fact that labor has access to capital goods. So Mises says this exploitation argument isn't a good idea. So what happens then if someone says, well, in order to prevent decrease exploitation or increase equality, we should tax capital, or say we should have high taxes on the rich to reduce inequality. So Mises responds to this, well, that won't help workers much. Suppose you took, say, the fortune of Bill Gates and just divided it up among his total fortune, divided them up among everybody in the world. It might not amount to that much for each person, but if you don't do that, rich person's going to let the rich person keep the money he has. He's going to invest it in capital goods, and that's the way workers' productivity will rise. And that's the main way that wages go up. So, again, Mises is arguing here, again, he's not making natural rights argument. He's not saying, well, the rich person is entitled to his money, say, if you don't take it away from them, it'll benefit the poor and the workers. So this is the kind of argument he likes. He doesn't like appeals to ultimate values. He doesn't engage in them. He just says, well, look, here's what you say you want. You say you want to benefit the workers and the poor. So the way to do that is just to allow the capitalists to accumulate capital, and in that way that'll benefit the poor. Okay, so I think we'll stop now and we can now take questions. I think were there some points people had raised in the chat I didn't get to? Let me just see. Okay, now Peter says, I always say capital are enslaved by laborers because if they didn't hire them, all their capital investment goes to waste. Well, this is actually an interesting point. Mises discusses that. He says some people say, look, the individual worker, say he's working for a large corporation, is going to not do very well, because suppose you're working for the McDonald's company. If you say, I don't like the wages you're offering, they don't really care. They can just hire somebody else. But won't they have much more bargaining power than you do? But the answer there is, well, if they offer substandard wages, then you could go, workers will tend to go to competing companies, and workers would tend to get what they produce, because if businessmen don't pay them that, it'll be to the advantage of one of their competitors to offer better wages, and so wages will tend to be bid up. Let's see, someone recommends reading George Reeson. Yes, that is a very good book. And now Mao says, it means it's right about a knowledge economy. How knowledge was restricted to the university, who has written on this. Well, I don't think Mises specifically wrote on knowledge economy as this term is used today. I mean, he certainly is aware that people's knowledge is very important. But I think what he would say, I mean, we go somewhat against it, is that physical resources, remember, are really needed for action. It wouldn't be right to say, well, now we have a new economy in which there are just ideas that physical resources aren't important. I think that would be a fundamentally wrong way of looking at the economy. Because we have better ideas, we're able to use physical resources in a more efficient way than we were before. Efficient in the sense we're able to get more of what we want with fewer, less expenditure resources. Now here's what Peter said. I missed out the first few minutes of the lecture where you were talking about production of product, not use. Is it true that it was a classical economist that came up with it? Well, I think the expression production for profit, not for use, I'm not sure who originated it. It was one very much used by the Marxists. That was one of their main claims. Marx and Friedrich Engels talked about that, and they said, well, under capitalism, you're just producing what will benefit the capitalists, what will give them profit, but we could have a system that was just trying to produce what people needed. We were going according to what people could use. Now, Mao said, referring to the last lecture, can you chat about the proles in the Roman Empire? Were they just wage laborers? You mentioned they were good for just pretty, how this system worked. Well, basically what happened, there were in the Roman Republic, there were various people were classed in certain ways when they were and then political representation based on how they were classed, and they'd have to pay. So people who didn't have much property were the proletari, so they would be valuable just for their labor, and also by reproducing, by having children, they would be giving people, say, could go into the army or could be used in production. So that would be their main way of contributing. I mean, they would be engaged in just ordinary labor. They could be working on agriculture production and so on. But it now says, would their children be sold? Oh, no, they weren't slaves. They would just be, they would be citizens in the Republic, but they would just not be have much, they would just not have much money. Now, Travis said, what do you make of these left-wing market anarchists or left libertarians who despise capitalism but love the free market? Well, is there a problem with capitalism? They seem to think capitalism is inherently state. Perhaps they're confusing laissez-faire free market capitalism with corporate state monopoly capitalism. Can you explain? Also, I believe libertarian doesn't belong on the right or the left. Would you agree? Well, I think when they're using capitalism in a different way from the way we're using this course, when we're talking about capitalism, here we basically mean a free market economy, one based on private ownership of the means of production. But the left libertarians don't like the word capitalism. They use that term to mean a system that was sometimes called crony capitalism, where businessmen get or allied with the state and get special privileges that aren't in accord with the genuine free market. And they tend to think that in, say, the contemporary U.S. economy, they tend to think that a lot of businesses fall into that category of benefiting from the state, and they think they wouldn't really exist in a free market, genuine free market. I don't think they're right on it. That's their view. On your other question was libertarianism belong on the right or the left? Well, I think it's a separate system, you know, that has its own features. And Travis says the word anarcho-capitalism solves this. Yes, although they don't like that term either, because they think capitalism is the system of state patronage. So they would call themselves maybe anarcho-libertarians. Now, Leslie said, so it means to say that a tax reduction on investment income would be more productive than a reduction in payroll taxes. I think this is a supply side argument for tax cuts for high income brackets. Mises would certainly say that a reduction in investment income would help workers. I mean, reduction taxes on investment would help the workers, but he wouldn't be, I mean, from what he says, he wouldn't be committed to saying how this would compare with other tax cuts. I mean, that would just depend on the empirical situation. You see, now, Dan says Rothbard blames Adam Smith for the use versus profit fallacy. So what he's saying there, I think, in this passage is that Smith distinguishing, of course, he's following, I think, Aristotle here, with the use value of a good, what you use the good for, and what the exchange value is, how much the good is used in what it'll get you in exchange. Say, suppose you say, well, shoes have a use value, you can wear them, that's what you would use them for. But say if you have a pair of shoes, you can also sell them, so that would be its exchange value. So Rothbard thinks that the use versus profit idea, production for use versus production for profit, comes from this separation between use value and exchange value, rather than taking both of these to be just ways in which a product has utility. I don't think he claims there that Smith used this phrase production for profit and production for use. That would be interesting to investigate. But I think he's just claiming that the source of fallacy of distinguishing production for use and production for profit comes from this distinction between use value and exchange value. That's interesting. It's a different though related claim. Ricardo had a theory of value that was based on a sort of labor theory of value, but I'm not sure what you are you're asking there. Now, Malik says, who came up with the concept of rate of return on investment tends to be equal in the economy? Well, this is one you find in all the, Adam Smith has that, and all the British classical economists was taken up by the Austrians. This is quite standard. I mean, because you could see right away if one business is profiting more than others, there'll be a shift in that direction till the rate of return is equalized. I mean, you'll find this in all the British, in Adam Smith, Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, everyone has this. You might find it earlier than that, but they are certainly ones who had that idea. Here's one from Travis. Noam Chomsky said, a consistent libertarian must oppose private ownership with means of production, wage slavery, which is a component of this system, is incompatible with the principle that labor must be freely undertaken and under control of producer. Chomsky would be among the other anarchists who look at anarcho-capitalism not being true anarchists or libertarians, would label such capitalist libertarians as being right-wing libertarians. Again, this is not me saying this. How would anarcho-capitalist respond to this? Well, I think the response there is he's wrongly assuming that under an anarcho-capitalist system, labor isn't freely undertaken, but just what's happening in that system is everyone, including laborers, is making an exchange that will benefit him. Otherwise, he wouldn't be doing it. I think Chomsky, although he's an anarchist, has an essentially Marxist view of how the economy operates. So he's thinking, well, under a free market, it's really the capitalists who are in control, who are exploiting the workers. The workers have no bargaining power. It's the big firms that are controlling everything. So just what we've been trying to argue in this lecture is the wrong way of looking at the capitalist is the way he adopts. So, as I say, although he's not a socialist in the sense he doesn't favor centralized control of the economy, he has a very similar analysis of capitalism to, if not identical analysis to capitalism, of one you'll find in the Marxists. And Chavez says, that's my understanding. I know he was at Left Forum last year. I was at Left Forum last year for class on anarchism. When I asked about anarcho-capitalism, they laughed and said there was no such thing. Everyone in the class. Oh, that's interesting. Amel said, Menger and Marx are about the same time. Can you speak of whose ideas influence whom in the pair and how they refute each other? Menger was certainly aware of Marx's ideas, and his student, Eugen von Bombarder, was the most important critic of Marxist economics. He has in his Capital and Interest, Volume 2, the chapter on the exploitation theory, and also his separate monograph, Karl Marx and the Close of His System. So those are basic criticisms of Marx. So Marx didn't influence the Austrians in the sense of having some kind of positive impact on everybody, but they were very strong critics of Marx. Now, Marx himself, there's some indication he had heard of some of the subjective theory of value toward the end of his life. Remember, he died in 1883, but he never wrote on that or indicated how it might change some of his own views. He was aware of earlier people who had had somewhat subjective theories of value. For example, in the Theories of Surplus Value, which wasn't published, he writes about Samuel Bailey, but he tends to be very dismissive of that view. Let's see. Travis has another comment here. Let me just see what the question is here. Also, according to anarcho-socialists, the private ownership of the means of production creates economic hierarchy instead of economic equality in the workplace. Class structure subordinates workers with wage slavery, and anyone who supports this is not a consistent libertarian, according to Chomsky. Of course, we can always reply, that any association exchange made in the free market is voluntary. In order for the association exchange to be made, both parties must find it to be mutually beneficial. Ensure competition between other capitalists would cause wages to rise. Although the third point will fall flat because they don't believe in wages in the first place. Another is, well, ultimately stand up against libertarian socialist critique of the private ownership of means of production. So how can we respond to this? What is this critique of the private ownership of the means of production? It seems to be just saying that private ownership is somehow illegitimate, but we could have responses to that by saying, we could have a sort of response, don't people have a right to acquire property individually? And aside from that, what about the argument we talked about in class today, that under a system of private ownership, it's the consumers who are really in control? So I think we would respond by just asking, what is supposed to be the basis for the claim that private ownership of the means of production is wrong? I mean, it's supposed to be used to speak of a critique, but what exactly is the critique? Now, I should say one thing. I think it's a problem with some of the left libertarians is that they basically accept large parts of this Chomsky-type critique. They say, this wouldn't apply in a genuine free market. They think under existing circumstances, large firms really do put workers at a disadvantage or so on. So I think they've taken over certain parts of this kind of non-free market approach to economics. Now, Danny said Marx's only reaction to marginal theory value would be postponing publication of later bond is main truth. Well, yes, you see, Marx's first volume, Capital, came out in 1867, and then the second and third volumes were published, I think, by Engels around in the 1890s. Marx died in 1883. His work was just in manuscript. Now, that's an interesting conjecture, means that was why he postponed the publication of a later volume, but that's just speculation. Marx didn't really say why he didn't publish these volumes. That's certainly a plausible conjecture. Now, Leslie points out the calculation argument. Yes, that's a very good point. You raise good. And Malcolm likes Mises' comment. Yes, it's a good comment. Now, Malcolm says, in Marx heard of subjective value, but never wrote about it. Does anyone after him on the left address the reality of subjective value? I see subjective value as main thing that the left never covers. Well, there were people, there were Marxists who tried to reply to the, criticize the subjective theory of value. For example, Rudolf Hilferding, who was in, was one who offered a reply to defending the labor theory against the Bombavik's criticism. Another one was Nikolai Bukharin, who later became one of the leading people in the Soviet system. He was executed by Stalin, but he was one of the leading Bolsheviks in the 1920s. But he was one who wrote. They claimed, Austrian, the subjective theory is really a bourgeois theory. They said, the reason these Austrians have come up with this theory is that they want to disguise the reality of class conflict. They're just riding in the interests of the capitalist class, trying to claim the subjective value, claim that capitalism is really not based on exploitation of labor. That's just concealing, that's just really class apologetics. So I think if you look at their work, I don't think, of course, they're able to sustain those points, but that would be the way they reply to the Austrian view. Now, Travis says, it seems to me that communal ownership of meaning production has failed time and time again. Ultimately, I like to identify myself as a libertarian anarchist, which encompasses my acceptance of voluntary socialism. I would not want to be a part of a voluntary social society, but I support anyone's choice to relinquish their property right. That way, I find it a much more accepted term. Yes, I think that's a very good way of looking at things. I mean, people are free to do what they want, even if it's not such a good idea. Now, Malcolm, can you talk about where class analysis originated, who originated, how it spread the concept? Well, the best thing, you should look at Ralph Rako has some excellent stuff on this. I'm sure Danny or Cam will have references immediately. But basically, it was the French classical liberals at the early 19th century, like Charles Dunoyer, Charles Comte, and the historian Augustin Thierry, who wrote about class, and what they meant was they would take the state as a way of oppressing other people, and they would say certain groups, by getting control of the state, would be able to use the state for their own benefit. And the Marxist view of class would take it in a different way, where you wouldn't be stressing particular groups taking the state, although you do have this, to some extent, say Marx has this, and sometimes we'll talk about groups seizing the state. I say, if you look at his book, 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, would be one where he has somewhat of a view of a state, somewhat like that of the French classical liberals. But basically, he's more concerned with the state as an instrument of a certain economic class, like the capitalist class. So he's taking it in a different direction from the French classical liberals. We still have time if anybody has a last question or annihilating objection, anything good. Now, Travis says he doesn't like that the word capitalism has a bad press. Some people don't like the word, you're quite right. Now, Malcolm asked a question. How did Marx explain the business cycle? Well, that's one of the most controverted points in Marx's theory. There are all sorts of different views on that. He apparently had a lot of different ways. Like one is he thought some people take Marx as an under-consumptionist. Some people take him, no, he was actually somewhat similar to the Austrians in stressing there was investment, malinvestment. There are different ways of looking at it. So as you say, that's one of the most disputed topics in Marx's economics, but he tends to think business cycles are going to get worse and worse, and that'll help bring about the collapse of capitalism. Well, all right. I think thanks. We had a small but select group. So thanks, everybody. I hope I'll see you all next week. And Malcolm says, oh, you went, oh, that's interesting. There was a historical materialism conference. Yes, there are still Marxists around there. They're definitely still there. Okay, thanks everybody. Hope to see you. Thank you everybody. Hope to see you all next week.